Welcome to the Launch Button Podcast, where we allot the secrets of successful entrepreneurs and real estate investors who found the courage to hit the launch button and take control of their destiny. Join me, Hugh Zaretsky, bestselling author, seasoned real estate investor, and serial entrepreneur, as we dive deep into inspiring stories and invaluable lessons that will empower you to break free from the ordinary and pursue your true passions. Are you feeling trapped in a job that drains your passion and leaves you yearning for more? Are you ready to accelerate your business and or real estate investing to take it to the next level? It's time to ignite your dreams and embrace the limitless possibilities that life has to offer. Get ready to launch into the life you've always desired by pressing the launch button. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Launch Button Podcast, where we talk to successful entrepreneurs that have launched their career or taken it to the next level as they go through the entrepreneurial roller coaster to help you understand that life is not a straight line. It's a lot of ups and downs on the entrepreneurial roller coaster. And today we've got a special guest. I've actually known her for like 20 years. It's pretty crazy when we go back in history. But she actually, a lot of people say they come from the streets of New York. She actually was on the streets of New York and made it all the way to Sex and the City and being able to be on one of the stand-ins for one of the top actresses on the show. And she's going to explain to you a little bit about her journey and how she came to success. So Heather, welcome to the Launch Button Podcast. We're excited to have you here, and tell everybody a little bit about your background and where you come from and how this all started way back in the day.
Thank you first, Hugh, for having me on here. It's great to be reunited with you after all these years. Yes, I am. I feel like I started off as an entrepreneur at age 8 when my family was going through a period of severe poverty and we needed money. And so I began to play my violin on the street corners of New York City. I first started on First Avenue and 59th Street, and then I moved myself to across the street from Trump Tower because that's where the money really was, and that's where all the tourists were. And so I think from an early age, I had an eye for knowing, how I could make the most money. And so I began playing my violin, and eventually my twin sister played her flute with me, and we played duets on the streets for many years. And then we ended up singing at Studio 54, which is a nightclub that was pretty legendary back in the day. It did close down like a year or a few months after we were singing there with this all girls rock group. And that was,
let's slow down right there. Cause a lot of people like go through life and then they become entrepreneurs. You were like survival mode. I need to be an entrepreneur and go make money at age 8. You guys heard it here. Like age 8. Yeah. Having to like learn the skills that people don't learn until when they're in their 30s and 40s to be like, go out there and do that. And then for people outside of New York, if you don't know what Studio 54 is, go watch some of those movies. You'll learn a lot about that. So at age 8, you guys are exposed to lots of things.
Yes. Yes. We were exposed to the gritty side, the glamorous side, the freaks and the people who really embraced us and made us feel like we were a part of their family. When you're working in a club as legendary as Studio 54, people, the people who are our handlers were, did take us under their wing and were very watchful and protective of us. And I remember like singing up on the rafters, which is this elevated stage, and singing songs that this woman wrote for us, Gina Wenkos. And we were singing songs called I Like Boys and My Daddy's Dead, He's a Pop in a Box. And I remember loving it because I knew that at the end of the day, at the end of the night, like at 3 o'clock in the morning, we were going to come home with $50. And that was going to help us, be able to go to D'Agostino's and get some groceries. So there were like, but also on the flip side, I was keeping all of this a secret from the friends that I was working with who were actually going to school, going to elementary school. And my, twin and I were not going to school, and we did not go to school from age 8 until 16. But I kind of liked at a young age, I liked the hustle and I liked being different. And I actually liked going for auditions and going by myself to big corporate buildings. And of course, business people would look at me like, what is this child doing here? But I always had my violin with me. I always felt really protected with my violin because I felt like if anything happened, I would just shove the violin into their face or whatever. But and I also had my sister, so I did feel really, I really did feel quite safe. I never ever felt like I never felt like I was in danger. But I did have big dreams of like, okay, these are stepping stones for how I'm going to earn more money for the family. And my dream was to become a professional actress at that point instead of just, struggling. But the club, being at Studio 54 was really the highlight of my childhood. Was one of my happiest days because everybody was so different there that I felt really, really accepted.
Yeah, and that is a legendary club in New York. Like, lots of crazy things happen there, and lots of everybody was accepted there. That was the great thing about it. But like, I just think about, I've worked in bars and clubs, and there's all sorts of unique things that happen in those environments, right? Where you're like, and to be at there at such a young age, you're getting, and you've already reached, like, people take their whole lives to get onto the stage of Studio 54, right? People are like, I'm sure there's some jealousy there, because there's people like 40, 50 years old being like, I only get one show there, and you guys are performing there all the time.
I remember walking past the bouncers and the velvet ropes and people were like, what? Why is this kid going in there? It was like 11 o'clock at night, and that's when I was beginning my job to sing there until like 2 or 3 in the morning. And we also did like a live art installation that was in the front of the club where it was like this little Alice in Wonderland reenactment with four other little girls. And we actually got photographed for Art Forum magazine. And my husband, when he worked at Getty Images, actually found that magazine. And I have a copy of it and I cherish it to this day.
That is
I cherish
awesome.
the photos. The photos are wild.
Oh, I'm sure. Like,
They're
that is
wild
awesome.
because
Because what?
Well, because I was 8 years old and I'm just this little thing in a pink frilly dress and pink bows. And it's in the midst of this club where people are wearing sequins and they're half naked and but they're all very just kind to us because we were sort of props, just like, oh, look at these little darling little girls. So it wasn't and we were treated with such revelry and just like, wow, who are these special little kids here? And also, Brooke Shields is a bit older than me, but she had been there. Drew Barrymore was there. Liza Minnelli, Truman Capote, like going way back, there were a lot of literary people that circled that place. It wasn't just the club kids. Like it was a big mix. Trump went there, like it was a big, not when I was there, but it was a mix of all of New York's successful people.
That was the place to be
That was
heard
the
and
place to
seen,
be.
right? Like, if you were going out in New York, like, that was the place to go. All the athletes went there, all the movie stars went there, right? That was the place to be seen. And there you are at 8 years old in that mix, which is wild and crazy for most people to understand. But for you, it's normal. You're like, hey, I'm just doing, because at that age, you're super adaptable. You don't know. You're just like, yeah, this is just what I do, right? Like, it's just normal for that. And for everybody out there that's listening, that, has gone through things, like, people just have different normals. And I say that it's just a different normal for everybody. That's what you're used to. So, and of course, then having the aspirations of being your actress and doing all that seem like nothing, because at eight, you're already doing it, right? At eight, you're already on stage. You're already doing that. But then it became a little bit more after Club 54 shut down, you had to sort of like recalibrate. So tell everybody a little bit through that.
So after that, we were doing some commercials, but we were not earning enough money. And my single mother was really dealing with some mental health issues. And she had worked, but then she couldn't work. And so we became homeless for a year in New York City, and we slept in shelters, subway cars, and we did stay with lots of strangers. And thankfully, through that year, people were benevolent enough to give up like their spare bedroom, and they were complete strangers that we had never met before. One woman was a butcher at the A&P supermarket on 8th Avenue, and mom and I and my sister were walking through, and mom said something like, "Oh, we're really hungry." And the woman was like, "Oh, well, why?" Mom's like, "We don't have anywhere to stay." And she was like, "You can come stay in my home." And she lived in the projects off of 10th Avenue with her. She was a single mother also. And she let us stay in her child's bedroom while her other, she had three other kids, while one of them like slept in the living room. And we were with them for a few weeks. And then I met this woman named Jill, who was the babysitter for those kids, while the mother was the butcher at the A&P store. And amazingly, 20 years later, I stayed friends with the babysitter, Jill. And I just would like, I mean, this is before cell phones and computers. And so I think I've just run into Jill in Hell's Kitchen, which is 9th Avenue, 46th Street. And I think I was in my 20s, late 20s, and she was like, "Oh, you should come to this vegetarian Buddhist party that my family has." And I was like, "What? You have a—" I never knew she had an extended family. And I said, "No, it's okay, I'm good. I don't want to come." And then she just kept saying, "Come on, come on, you got to do this. It's gonna be really fun. There's free food." I was like, "All right, there's free food. Let's do again." I was like, "Let's do this." And I show up, and there is Zach, my future husband, which I didn't realize at the time. And it happened to be a birthday party for this Indian girl, like her half birthday party. And it just, what that showed me was that everything happens for a reason. And if I had never been homeless at age 10, I never would have met Zach, my husband, when I was 30. And that was just incredible thread. That just is remarkable. It shows you like things really do happen for a reason, and trust your journey.
Just say yes to the opportunities, right? That's
Yes,
one of the biggest things.
always say yes, because I would say no to Jill, and then finally Jill just would not give up, and then I was like, okay, all right, fine. And then boy, am I glad I went, because I have two beautiful daughters today and a great relationship with my husband.
Yeah, and that's how we met. We met through your husband
Yes.
when he worked at
Exactly.
Getty Images, that we
Full
both worked at
circle.
Getty
Yeah.
Images. Yeah, full circle. Going through that, and Zach and I had become friends playing softball and soccer and all the different things over the years. And so that's how we really got a chance to know you when you came into the picture, and then going through that whole process and watching you guys grow as a family. And now seeing your kids performing on stages and, following in your footsteps and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But as you've gone through this process of, you seem to constantly be in areas where there were famous people around, whether that
Right.
was at Coat Check, whether that was at different places. So tell everybody a little bit how you, from Club 54, how you stayed sort of in the semi spotlight.
Right. So because I had such a early exposure to working in discos and clubs, they felt like a safe place. So when I got older and I was in my 20s, I worked at first I worked at Stephen Baldwin's lounge, which was called Aaliyah. And it was he's the brother of Billy Baldwin and
Yeah,
Alec Baldwin,
Alec
right?
Baldwin, yeah.
So he was really funny, because every time he would see me, he would like sort of shake my hand and be like, "Oh, nice to see you." Sort of like he had never seen me before, which made me feel really invisible. But then also on the flip side, I was like, well, at least I have a job. And he was completely harmless. But then from there, I went to work at the Kit Kat Club, which is where Jay-Z would often hang out. And I was working as a cocktail waitress. And one day, there was somebody yelled, "There's a gun!" And everyone started. This is a huge club on like 48th Street, 43rd or 48th. Huge club. Everyone's ducking underneath the tables, and I'm ducking underneath the table. And I've got my little tray that I'm like holding, so I don't like if there's a bullet or whatever. And I realized, you know what, life at that point is extremely fragile, and that place was not a safe place at all. And I was like, what do I really, really want to do with my life? And I didn't know, it wasn't like a light bulb moment, like, oh, well, this is what I'm going to do with my life. But it was the beginning of me trying to figure out what kind of legacy I wanted for my life. So I ended up after that, I still have to pay the rent. I have a little had a little studio apartment that was 123 feet on the Upper West Side. And I'm single, living alone, loving living alone next to Central Park. And so I ended up getting a job at hold on, I'm just blank. Oh, at Moomba, which is where like George Clooney and Cameron Diaz, Madonna, all these big superstars would come, and they'd go to the upstairs lounge, and they would some would check their coats with me. So one evening, Leonardo DiCaprio came by, and I was like, oh, he's not gonna check his coat with me, no way. But he stopped, and he was super sweet and kind, and he said, life is a gift, don't waste it in the coat room. And I was like, oh, sure, yes, thank you for telling me that. And then he handed me a $100 bill, and I was very impressed by that because my boss, seems so nuts to me now, was only paying me $3 an hour, but he was like, but it's under the table, it's all cash. And now
No
I'm just
taxes.
like, $3 an hour. I just looked that up in one of my diaries, by the way, because I have 17 diaries from my 20s. I was always writing things down because I knew I wanted to write a book someday. But that blew my mind that I was being paid that. But he did say, well, there's some nights you're going to get these $100 tips. And I did record that some nights I would earn $300, $400 a night. There were nights when it was super slow, like a Monday night when I would earn $25. But
Really?
anyways, when Leonardo DiCaprio left, gave me the $100, I was like, okay, this is good. But I still didn't know what to do. So of course I was a chain smoker back then, and I lit up another cigarette, sat on my stool, and this coat check room is like there's coats up here, there's coats up here. You're literally just like locked in. There's coats down. It's a
Right.
tiny space, and there's a rug and carpeting. And so at like around 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, I've like fallen asleep on the side of I've like let the cigarette dangle or whatever. My boss comes yelling at me. He's like, you're putting burn holes in the carpet. And he fired me. And I was like, oh, this was such a cushy job. Damn it. Just kind of freaking blow it. But like we said before, things do happen for a reason. So the next day, I was rollerblading like I did every day all over town, and just feeling the breeze and the beauty of being in New York City when you're in your 20s, and checking out everybody and just being like, oh, this is I love New York City, fabulous life. And I rollerbladed past Rockefeller Center, and that's where I had grown up ice skating up until the age of 6. When my mom all of a sudden was like, we can't come here anymore, we don't have any money. And I was like, oh, I accepted that, easily. And so I'm standing there at Rockefeller Center looking at all the ice skaters, remembering all the wonderful moments I had with all the people who skated there. Because back in those days in the 80s, there were a lot of, it was like a community. It was Misfits, but it was also a bunch of German people who had their lederhosen and their skating outfits, and there were professional ice skaters. It wasn't all tourists. Like it was
Yeah, it
and it
was
was a
much
lot of
more.
yeah, it was a lot of elderly people too who had skated for 40 years and were not going to give up skating just because they were old. So anyway, so I'm standing there and I was like, you know what? I should get a job downstairs at the American Festival Cafe. And I walked down there with take off my blades, and Frank Sinatra's blaring My Way. I did it my way. And I didn't even grow up listening to Frank Sinatra, but I was like, oh, I love this. And this gentleman named Peter, the guy who ran the place, comes over and interviews me, and he's just the kindest guy from Queens, total New York guy. He understood, and I start telling him my story, and it
Right.
was just like, it was two native New Yorkers coming together and finding just like, I don't know, we sort of like understood each other. And that ended up being my longest job. And while I was there, I would, I was a hostess. I would look at the people ice skating and remember the beautiful times I had with my family. So it was like, it was a very calm and homey place. And I felt like I had finally found my home. And
That's
then,
awesome.
yeah. And then years later, many years later, in my 40s, I would do a DNA test, and I would find out that I had searched for my father. My mother had told me my father had died
Wait,
before.
before we go down that, because I know that's gonna be a touchy
Okay.
subject. I want to certainly dive into one thing. There is something interesting when you say like he was a New Yorker and there's an instant bond. It's so true. Like whenever you find like other New Yorkers in different parts of the country or around the world, it's like you sort of understand each other right away. And New Yorkers get a bad rap often. Now you've been telling us stories here about how so many people have taken you in and supported you and your sister, right? I feel New Yorkers get a bad rap because we're very direct. We're like, hey, if you're hey, like we're not doing it any which way. We're just telling you, hey, speed up or get out of the way. If not, big or something. And it's like, oh, okay. Like sometimes you need that to like snap out of it. But if New Yorkers love you, they love you. Like they go to the end of the earth for you, or they just don't care and they're like, okay, have a good day.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, I mean, I could tell you countless stories of all the people that took us in from another Buddhist guy who ran a magazine that mom found at the health food store, like one of those free magazines. Mom ended up calling the number in the back of the magazine, and he and his wife like took us in. Just, I mean, why? Oh, a puppeteer took us in, a guy who had puppets, who life-size puppets. We had so many random adventures that year of just living with strangers, and I would love to actually to thank them. I don't know how I could, but that would be like a dream of mine someday to see them one day and, just say thank you so much for that, saving us from the streets.
Well, part of that's going to be in your book, and that's going to be the thing, right?
Yeah.
When so I know when I did my book, that was part of it was like, hey, you're acknowledging the people, you tell the stories along the way, and that people are like, oh, I didn't realize I meant that much to you. And I'm sure you're going to have lots of those when you release your book.
I'm working on the book. It's in progress. It's called The Stand-In. And I am submitting it to literary agents right now. It is complete at 70,000 words, but yeah, it's definitely I'm really excited about that project.
Yeah. And if you guys are on any of the podcast channels besides YouTube, you would not guess which one of the four Sex and the City stand-ins she would be. But if you're on YouTube, it's pretty obvious on who it is. And we'll get there as she gets there in her story. But let's circle back to because you thought your dad, your mom had always told you your dad had died, and yet then you took that DNA test. What was the preface of taking the DNA test in the first place?
I think I really wanted to find him, and I really felt like he was alive. I could feel it in my bones. And I didn't really believe my mother's stories. And I think when I was pretty much in my teens and my 20s, and then once the science caught up to all my questions, because mother just continued with the story that he had died in Denmark, that I was really excited to do the DNA test. And I think it took about 5 years for somebody to finally be a match on that DNA
Okay.
test. And it was a
You took
cousin.
it first. So you took it first, and then it was in the database, and then other people were giving their DNA. Okay.
So I did two different DNA tests, and only one came up as a match because that cousin happened to take that test. So that was a lucky break. If he hadn't taken that test, I would never have found out. Because even though the DNA test does tell like here's the percentage of this ethnicity, it doesn't always link you to a family
Right.
member. But that was a lucky break.
So you're a cousin, a distant cousin of your, or a cousin of yours took the test. Now you've matched. So walk us through that process of finding your dad.
So one day I open up the DNA portal website, and it says you have a match. There's a first cousin, and it had a name, and I was super excited. And I wrote on the portal, "Hey, it says you're my first cousin. Would you like to meet?" I live in New York City. And that person took 6 months to respond to me, which got me really worried because I thought, oh God, they're not going to respond to me. This sucks. And then I thought, well, they must be in Denmark because mom said he died in Denmark. And I even went, by the way, a few years before that, I even went to Denmark on a lark with my violin, and I was playing in a string quartet. And I called my mom up and I said, you know, I'm here for a short while and I'm going to find my father. And she's like, well, I told you he died. And I said, well, then I'm going to find my father's family. And I have these very odd shaped thumbs that are very weird. You can't really see in the light. But, and so I was like, well, I'm going to find my father's family, just based on these funny shaped thumbs. And mom was like, oh, they all died in the fire. And I was like, what fire? You never told me about a fire.
So she
So
doubled down
then,
on the lie.
so she doubled down. Yes. But you know, some people either double down or they tell the truth. And I think
Yeah, it's one or the
for
other. Like,
her, it was like,
you gotta
it
go
was just
all in.
like,
You gotta like go all
yeah.
in, right? Like, you're either
And
like
I,
die
you know what?
or go
I have told lies, but then I always end up confessing. And the people that I've confessed to have been like, it's okay because our relationship is strong enough and can handle it. So I am an advocate for telling the truth. It's okay if you lie. You can make up, you know, you can make mistakes. But anyway, so back to the DNA story. So he finally responded and he said, oh, I'm actually in New York City. The name that's on the DNA website is actually a pseudonym, a fake name. This is my real name. I was like, what? Not another person with the name. Come on. Can somebody be real? So I said, okay. So he's like, we'll meet in New York City. I live in New York City. And when we met at this restaurant, a lot of my friends were like, you shouldn't just meet up with some random stranger because it could be a axe murderer. But I'm a very trusting person. And I was like, listen, I've been at Studio 54. I've been in clubs. I've got this. It's daylight. Hello. It's, you know, Union Square. No big deal. So anyway, so I get there and this wonderful guy who's about 10 years older than me, he super sweet. He's like, don't you remember me as a kid? And I'm like, no. And he said, well, I used to watch you ice skate as a child. Because he was 10 and I was a baby, and then I was 4, and then he was whatever the math is, 12 or 13. And then he said his uncle, who was the ticket taker and the guy who did the Zamboni machine, who rode the Zamboni machine, he said, that was your father. And I was like, what? Are you kidding me? And then he pulled out photos of that time at the rink, you know, wearing the skating costumes. And I didn't remember him because as a little kid, I'm really good at little boys. But I remembered his sister. She's 8 years older than me because she was this gorgeous blonde figure skater who had the fairy princess costumes and and so I was like, and all of a
All the
sudden she
costumes
came,
you wanted, right? Like,
yeah, and all of a sudden she comes into the restaurant from behind, and I was like, oh my gosh. And she looked to me exactly how I remembered as a kid. She's still beautiful blonde woman. And her voice is exactly like her mother's. And anyway, so it was just crazy because they were like, we knew you, but your mother said that your father had died in Denmark. But they said at the rink, the big joke was, oh, look, here comes his children because we look so much like him. So that was a huge revelation. That was actually, it was earth shattering. It destroyed me, but it also made me feel whole at the same time. So it was heartbreaking, but it had to be done. And I am so grateful that I did it because without knowing that, I don't know, I feel like I'd still be out there searching for him. And now that I know I can have closure, and that's really, and also for my children to know their heritage. And yeah, I want to live the most authentic life that I can without secrets.
So n not knowing the story fully, right? To ice skate in that place is not usually cheap, even back then.
Right. So
Right.
he must have been giving her free tickets, you know, like he must have been because he was dating her. So he must have just been like, come on the ring, come.
Right. If he's a Zamboni driver, it sort of makes sense because you're like,
Right.
that was one thing that I was going to ask you during your story. I was like, but Rockefeller, like, there's other places to skate in New York City
Yeah.
and that are a lot cheaper than that. Like, if your family's tight on money, like,
Yeah.
that doesn't the ideal place to go. But, and now it makes sense, right? It comes full
Right?
circle.
Totally. And mom had skated there, I think, for 10 years before we were born. She also, when I confronted her about it in the most gentlest of ways, because I still wanted her to tell me the truth, I didn't really want to confront her in an angry way because she's a single mother who's the only parent I've had. But when I did, and I showed her pictures of him, she was like, oh, I don't remember him at all. And but she's like, but I babysat the children, you know, before you guys were born. And I was very close to that family. And so it's just like, what? Yeah, it was kind of mind-boggling.
But also back then, like, people didn't talk about those things, and there were all these secrets. Like, during COVID, I found out my last name's not very unique, and so
Right.
there, we didn't know anybody on my dad's side of the family. And then oftentimes there's people like, oh, do you know Dr. Zaretsky? And I'm like, right here in New York City, I'm like, no, like. But there can't be that many of us. Like, we got to be related somehow. And then we, through some stuff, like, I ended up doing work for a charity. And then they ended up being like, hey, we find people. Who should we find? I was like, well, my dad said he got into a, his mother got into a fight with somebody else's mother, and they never saw that side of the family again. Like, that's how it was back then. Like, you just don't
Right.
talk about it. You don't ever talk. Like, he's only mentioned that story like twice, like your mom, that like there was this big blow up on Thanksgiving. And I
Right.
found it when we went to reconnect, and my dad didn't want to reconnect. And I was like, but the fight wasn't you. You were seven. Like, he was like your age, seven, playing outside with his cousins. And all of a sudden, they're like, nope, we're going home. And they never saw him again.
Right. And
He's
I
like,
think
I don't
also,
want to meet him again.
I totally hear you. Yeah, I think also like back then there was a lot of shame, and she, you know, was an older mother. She was 38 when she gave birth to us, so she really wanted children, and she did not want a husband. She did not want somebody else telling her what to do. I think that was also. She was just like, nope, I'm raising these kids the way that I want to, and you know, I'm gonna have my own life. I don't need you. So good for her for being so independent and strong-willed.
Yes.
I
And
can
you're
say
not
that
strong-willed at
as a
all. Like,
woman,
yes.
not
And
as
you're
her
not
daughter.
strong-willed at all. Like, that's why
Yeah.
you stick to things. Like, you just adapt. One of the things I've always loved about you is like, you're like, oh yeah, I just roll and adapt into this, right? I just roll and adapt into that. And being from a, you know, your young age as a child, you're just able to adapt. So tell
Yeah.
us how, as you, before we wrap up this episode, and we'll dive deeper into how you writ roll, how you divide the entrepreneur roller coaster. And we'll talk more about the book on the Inside podcast, but tell us how you got that opportunity with Sex in the City, just the
Right.
highlight.
Right. So I was working at the Rockefeller Center ice rink restaurant called American Festival Cafe. My boss, Peter, who I adored, kept saying, and other people at NBC, you know, like lots of people from NBC, like Saturday Night Live were coming through to have like their dinners late at night. And they were all, I mean, a lot of people were like, you should do stand and work on Sex and the City. And you know, they're like, you look like Sarah Jessica Parker. And I was like, okay, I'll check that out. So I went to the casting director, rollerbladed downtown, and the casting director was like, no, you're too big, because I am a lot taller than her. And I don't really look that, I am a lot just wider. But they just kept saying, no. And then my boss was like, but you can get health insurance if you and you can stop be, you know, stop working at this waitressing job. And maybe it's a stepping stone. Maybe it'll give you a, you know, a speaking part or something. So I just kept rollerblading down there, and finally they had an opening for Kristen Davis, who plays Charlotte, because that stand-in had left or whatever, because there was too, you know, it's like 60-hour work weeks. And then so and it could be like 30 hours or 60 hours, depending on when they're called. And so I got the job, and I was thrilled because I thought, okay, this is now I'm finally on my way. And there was, there was a nice point where they did let me play my violin on one of the last episodes with Mikhail Baryshnikov in front of Lincoln Center, with Sarah Jessica Parker, and that was the highlight of my job, that night when I played my violin with the string quartet. But I ended up also leaving that show because I worked there for 4 years and I realized this is a, like sometimes you want that dream job and you're like, oh, this is the dream job. This is what I really, really want. If I get this, then this is going to happen. And then you get in it and you're like, oh no, nope, we are not going anywhere. This is, they're like, thank you for being mid-level. Thank you for being the quiet stand-in who just does what's told and doesn't ruffle any feathers. But you're not advancing. Like we're not giving out, like, you're not getting a promotion. That's not how it works. So yeah. So I ended up having to leave. Do you want me to keep telling more, or is there
No,
more?
let's just talk about that for a second, because I think that's a big part too. That a lot of people are like, when I get this, then I'm gonna have that. Or, everybody's like, well, I'm gonna get my dream job, and when I get that, then it's all these things are gonna open up. And I've always had this rule, like, you gotta say yes if it's 70 to 80% of what you want, you say yes, because you're never gonna get the perfect thing. And sometimes when we wait for the perfect thing, then it turns out not to be what we wanted. And in your case, you're like, that's my dream job. Like, I'm gonna get there, I'm gonna be on it. And then you got it, and you're like, oh, that's not it, right? Like, and how did that, walk us through that a little bit as you're going through that realization? Just, it's like, you're like, it's a stepping stone, it's the dream. And then all of a sudden you're slowly like, wait, but it's not, right?
So, I ended up, spending, you could be on set for 10 or 15 hours a day. I started bringing books and novels and thinking I need to open myself up to more experiences. And I hadn't been traditionally educated as a young person. So I thought, well, I'll start doing, I'll read Seed of the Soul by Gary Zukav, which is an Oprah book. And talking about manifesting. So I was like, oh, I will manifest these things. And I do believe that stuff does work. And then I did start doing Julia Cameron's Morning Pages. Have you ever heard of that, Julia Cameron's? So it's where every day you write 3 pages in the morning. And I felt like that actually was life-changing because I started being more aware of the habits I was doing, just the even the dating pool of what I repeating things I was repeating, and just job choices and the way I was responding to my mother and my family. So it just was, it just, I think those morning pages after I did them for a year, it was sort of like a map of how to get out of, where, because I'm a big believer in transformation and constantly improving oneself. So I do remember reading a lot of self-help books, bringing them to set, and just being like, I've got to work on this. So I started writing, and writing was the path out of being an actor. It was the path of getting out of the shadows and, really finding my own voice.
And you've written a lot of stories about your time there, right? On the set, and about part of that, and that's really sort of started your journey then into wanting to write the book. And it's so, even though it wasn't perfect, it allowed you an opportunity to grow, right? You realized, and you took advantage of that. You said yes to that and started going into personal development and personal growth, and then took off in a new direction. And now you truly are doing what you want to do, right? Like, it
And
turned.
I also have to credit, like, after like Sex and the City was about to end, and I quit, I think it was like the final season that I quit being a stand-in, but then I got that performance opportunity where I play the violin. And that was a night, that was the last time I was ever on set. And that was very bittersweet. I don't think anybody knew that was going to be the last time. I don't think I knew that was the last time, but it was. But after that, I kept seeing on billboards advertisements for the New School University, which is downtown, and they have a continuing education department. And I entered that. And I think there's a lot to be said for mentors that come into your life. And I had a teacher named Susan Shapiro who still works there, or who still teaches. And she said, lead the least secretive life you can, and you will be happy. And when I first got there, I was writing fiction because I'd read all the Sex and City books, and I mean, not books, the one Sex and City book, but read books similar to that. And then I was like, you know what? I'm not a novelist. Like, I really, really do want to write a memoir and write. And she was like, well, the first way you can do that is write personal essays. And I started publishing personal essays in the Washington Post, in Glamour Magazine, The Independent, like a whole slew of magazines, and I love it. Like, that is really I also, like, editors became like my first therapists, because they would read a piece that I had written and they would say, you're not digging deep enough. You need to dig here and here and here. And but that's also back when editors did stuff like that. Today, editors want your piece to be absolutely perfect. But the good thing is, I've been writing for so long that my pieces are not as sloppy as they were, before. So they are a little bit, so they are being accepted, because I've had, like, Michael Gladwell always, not Michael, Malcolm Gladwell always speaks about the 10,000 hours of learning. I got my 10,000 hours of learning in for writing. So I've, pretty much got a handle on that.
Awesome. Well, so we're gonna dive into the right inside on the inside podcast. Go
Okay.
deep. We're gonna put all of Heather's information below so you can get on the list for when the book does come out. You can follow her writing on the magazines. For all the women out there that are thinking about following it, wanted to jump into entrepreneurship or to follow their dreams and li leave that safety net behind, maybe of a corporate job like Zach has, or those types of things. What's a good piece of advice from your life lessons?
Get a mentor. Find a female mentor. Girls Right Now is a wonderful place to even become a mentor. You don't necessarily have to be a writer. You just have to be a person who's interested in helping others and helping other young women find their voice. Yeah, I would strongly recommend finding mentorship or
Awesome.
becoming a mentor. Yeah. And
Awesome. And I mean,
it's Girls Right Now, WRITE, so Girls Right Now.
awesome. So as you've listened to the story and you've heard her transformation from 8 years old, performing in one of the top clubs, which just still blows my mind, like on that, to right, having her dream job, what wasn't her dream job, to now flowing that into truly what she's passionate about and what lights her up. You can see that when she starts talking about the writing, how she gets all excited about it. And you can see the big smile on her face at that point. And that's what we're going to dive into on the Inside podcast. But for everybody out there, that's the entrepreneur roller coaster. It's the ups, the downs. It's just flowing with it, saying yes to the opportunities, and continuing to take one more step. So make sure when the chips are down, you just get out of your head, get into your body, and take one more step towards success, and you'll reach your goals. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you for joining us on the Launch Button Podcast, your gateway to unlocking your true potential and pursuing your passions. Don't let the journey end here. For more empowering insights, valuable resources, exclusive content, and free giveaways, visit www.thelaunchbuttonpodcast.com. At The Launch Button, we're dedicated to helping you break free from the ordinary and embrace a life filled with purpose and fulfillment. Dive deeper into our episodes, access bonus materials, and connect with like-minded individuals on our website and our private community group. Are you ready to take the next steps towards your dreams? Subscribe to The Launch Button Podcast on your favorite podcast platform and never miss an episode. Remember, the power to transform your life lies within your grasp. Press the launch button and soar towards success. For more updates, behind-the-scenes content, and exclusive offers, follow us on social media, join the conversation using hashtag the launch button, and share your journey with our vibrant community. Thank you for being a part of the Launch Button family. Together, let's ignite our dreams and embark on this journey together of growth and discovery. Visit www.thelaunchbuttonpodcast.com and let's continue to launch your greatness. See you there.